Hello, and welcome to another podcast of U.S. History Repeated with Jimmy and Gene. This is Jimmy LaSalle. Today, we start our coverage on what happened within the U.S. in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor. This particular subject will span a few podcasts, and we will dig into Japanese internment. And now, without any further ado, here is our resident history expert, Gene Anzanakis. Jeannie, take it away.
All right. So today, we're going to be talking about what happens within the United States in the aftermath of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Yes, the United States declares war on the Empire of Japan. Yes, Germany and its allies declare war on the United States. So the United States is 100% now involved in World War II, but we also respond with taking Japanese American citizens and forcing them out of mainstream society and into camps. Now, over history, the terms used to describe these camps have changed. If you look at World War II propaganda, you will see these camps being referred to as wartime communities. Perhaps in school, you learned about this chapter of American history as Japanese internment camps. Today, the proper term is Japanese incarceration or concentration camps. Now, some people have a very hard time labeling the camps within the United States as concentration camps because when people think of the term concentration camps, they think of the Holocaust. Now, as someone who has been to one of those concentration camps in Poland, I was at Auschwitz. I can tell you those, of course, had a very, very different purpose. But these are not wartime communities. These are not places where people wanted to be. And I hope that over the course of the next three episodes, we can shed some light on what this experience was like for Japanese Americans and Japanese citizens living in the United States. It's important to understand the history of anti-Asian sentiments and the history of laws that restricted Asian Americans in the United States well before Executive Order 9066 was enacted. If you look at the Chinese Exclusion Act, for example, that was passed in 1882. And that law suspended immigration for 10 years, and it was repeatedly renewed. That law also required Chinese people to carry documentation at all times, and it refused Chinese people the ability to become naturalized citizens. Chinese Americans were also not allowed to testify in court. This law was not revoked until 1943. Then you have the Gentlemen's Agreement, which was an informal agreement between the United States and Japan in 1907, where the United States would not publicly ban Japanese immigrants like the way they did with Chinese immigrants. And in response, Japan wouldn't send Japanese immigrants looking for work. Due to this restriction and strict immigration laws that were passed in the 1920s, by the time of the attack on Pearl Harbor, there are about 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry living in the mainland of the United States along the West Coast. Now, there was a significant Japanese population in Hawaii, on the Hawaiian Islands, but that is not a state yet. It is a territory of the United States at the time of World War II. Statistics show that of that 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry living in the mainland of the United States, two-thirds of that number were American citizens who had been born and raised in the United States. After the attack on Pearl Harbor, there was political debate about the need to protect the country against another attack from the Japanese. The fear of espionage and racism all led to the eventual passage of a series of executive orders, the most egregious being Executive Order 9066, Prior to the forced removal from the West Coast, assets were frozen, and the FBI, led by J. Edgar Hoover at the time, he had compiled a list of about 1,500 people of Japanese ancestry that the FBI believed needed to be watched. Those individuals were arrested the day after the attack. Many of them remained detained for the duration of the war. In addition, on January 14th, 1942, FDR issued Executive Order 2537, which required non-US citizens from World War II, enemy countries like Italy, Germany, and Japan, to register with the United States Department of Justice. They were then issued a certificate of identification for aliens of enemy nationality. Then came Executive Order 9066. This granted the Secretary of War and his commanders the power, and this is a direct quote, to prescribe military areas in such places and of such extent as he or the appropriate military commander may determine, from which any or all persons may be excluded, end quote. There was no specific individuals or locations listed in the order. It was broad and it was left up to interpretation. Now, in my discussion with the FDR Presidential Museum and Library, and if you listened to that episode, you heard this, FDR's thinking was that key areas that were essential for both the war effort and the safety of the nation would be chosen, that those areas would be off limits to persons of Japanese ancestry. And instead, that broadness of the executive order, it was very quickly applied to just about the entire Japanese American population on the whole West Coast. The Secretary of War at the time was a man by the name of Henry Louis Stimson, and he had been Secretary of War under President Taft, Secretary of State under Herbert Hoover, and again, Secretary of War under FDR. He was a conservative Republican. Military advisors pushed for legislation to protect the West Coast. Stimson was initially against Japanese incarceration, but he eventually gave in to the demands of military leaders. The largest population of Japanese living in the United States territories, or in the United States in general, were the Hawaiian Islands, which is a territory. It's not a state yet, like I mentioned earlier. The large numbers of people of Japanese ancestry made up a majority of the workforce on the islands, and they could not be removed. It would have had a devastating political and economic effect on the islands. Japanese immigrants to Hawaii were prohibited from becoming citizens. The big question was, how do you determine someone's loyalty? Can you ask them? Can you believe their answer? Do you get them to prove it to you? How do they prove it to you? What would be enough? I mentioned earlier that Executive Order 9066 was left up to interpretation, and military generals in charge of making sure it was followed made those interpretations. General John DeWitt was a three-star U.S. Army general. He believed that the Japanese people living along the West Coast were conspiring against the country and that they needed to be removed. There were many other people who believed this as well at the time. And in order to conduct this removal of people from the West Coast, the War Relocation Board was created. Military areas one and two were created, and they consisted of California and parts of Washington, Oregon, and Arizona. Japanese Americans living in these zones would be scheduled for evacuation. On March 18th, 1942, the WRA was formed via another Executive Order 9102, with Milton S. Eisenhower as the original director. Now, that name, or at least the last name, should sound familiar. He was the younger brother of future President Dwight Eisenhower. He wanted to limit the incarceration of Japanese to men only and allow women and children of Japanese ancestry to remain free. Governors of states feared the backlash of allowing Japanese Americans or immigrants to live amongst the general population of the state. and Milton Eisenhower resigned after 90 days. He was replaced by Dillon S. Meyer. He would eventually see the mass incarceration of Japanese Americans as a mistake, but the damage had been done. 10 camps were eventually created. Japanese Americans and immigrants had to leave their homes almost immediately, some only having 2 days to sell what they could and bring only what they could carry. Most people had 6 days to do this. Prior to arrivals at camps, Japanese Americans and Japanese immigrants were brought to what was known as assembly centers. Now, I want to make sure you understand the usage of terms. Assembly centers is what the government used to describe these places. It gives the idea that this is a building equipped to handle this mass movement of people and to provide adequate housing. They were far from it. The majority of these assembly centers were once racetracks or fairgrounds. Stables and livestock areas were cleaned out for families of up to 6 people, and they were now put into these spaces. Then they had communal bathrooms, laundry rooms, and mess halls. Gone was the family unit. Gone was your business and your beautiful home. Now you are living where animals had been not too long ago. It still smelt like the animals that had previously been there. There were jobs available at assembly centers and eventually the camps, but the thought was that individuals at these camps should not be paid more than an army private. So if you were a doctor, if you were a teacher, or you were a laborer, you were all paid the same amount as an army private. Some locations even had people working to make camouflage nets for the military. Following the executive order, American citizens and resident aliens of Japanese ancestry living in states like Washington, Oregon, California, and Arizona, they were ordered to evacuate their homes and businesses and report to 17 temporary assembly centers. And these were located at fairgrounds, racetracks, and other makeshift facilities. At these centers, which essentially served as a temporary detention facility, a family usually lived in a single horse stall for up to 100 days, and they had straw-filled bags for beds. There were shortages of food and other materials and just deplorable conditions. And this was a common theme at all of the centers. And from these centers, the incarcerated Japanese Americans were then sent to one of 10 war relocation centers. But today, we refer to those centers as concentration camps. The war relocation centers or concentration camps were located in inland areas away from the population centers of cities and towns and states, frequently on land that was already owned by the federal government that had good transportation linkages. They were designed to be self-contained, self-sufficient communities, complete with hospitals, post offices, schools, warehouses, offices, factories. Then they would have residential areas, and then they had farm areas because they wanted the people of the camps to be able to grow their own food. Of the 10 camps constructed, 2 each were located in California, Arizona, and Arkansas, and 1 each was located in Wyoming, Idaho, Colorado, and Utah. 2 of the camps in Arizona were located on Native American lands, actually, and tribal leaders naturally protested, but they were overruled by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The layout of the camps varied, but certain elements were consistent, including this perimeter, which was defined by guard towers and barbed wire fences. You know, if a place is so nice, you don't need a guard tower and barbed wire fences and men with guns pointing them at you for people to stay. Main roads in the centers were occasionally paved, but most of the time they were unpaved. And so depending upon the weather in the area, you could either have muddy or dry or dust. Of the people who were incarcerated, 30,000 were children, most of whom were school aged. Schools were built and teachers were brought in to teach. During World War II, there was a national teacher shortage, and class sizes were large, with most elementary school classes having about 48 students per class. Teachers who taught in the camps were required to live in the camp. They were paid 3 times the salary of a regular teaching job somewhere else in the United States. The only difference, of course, was if you were a person of Japanese ancestry, and if you were hired to work as a teacher, then you were paid the same as an army private. Along with schools, each camp had farmland and livestock. Detainees were required to grow food and to take care of the animals. Each camp was surrounded by barbed wire and had guarded towers with armed men. Riots would often break out in the camps because of overcrowding and insufficient rations. Some people were shot for walking too close to the fences. And despite these harsh living conditions, Japanese Americans in the camps were determined to make the camps feel like a community. Newspapers were established, clubs, sports teams, even baseball teams were created. One of the most well-known camps was Manzanar, which was located in California by the Sierra Nevada Mountains. Manzanar was the first of the 10 camps that would open and operate until the end of World War II. It was also one of the best preserved of the camps. Over 10,000 Japanese Americans were incarcerated at Manzanar. The extreme weather in the area made life especially difficult. Temperatures in the summer would get as high as 100 degrees, and in the winter, you would see snowfall and temperature in the 30s. The barracks had partitions in the sleeping quarters, but they didn't go all the way up to the ceiling. So if you were to stand on furniture, you could see into the living place of another family. Or sometimes if your family wasn't large enough, let's say you were a young unmarried couple, well, they would put you with other people. You didn't get to have your own 20 by 20 room. You had to then share it. There was a total lack of privacy. You have sleeping quarters, but then you also have communal bathrooms and communal showers. There are no partitions. You are sitting next to somebody on a latrine. You are standing next to someone else taking a shower. How many people would feel comfortable living day in and day out for years in that type of setting? Constantly waiting on lines to eat, on lines to shower, on lines to do laundry, on lines to use the bathroom. Meal times were strict. Food was only served during meal times for 1 hour. Sometimes people had to eat outside regardless of the temperature due to rationing. Meals often didn't include meat, so it was you kind of had to eat what they had. Tule Lake, which we're going to spend the next two episodes on, was the most infamous of the camp. Originally, it was similar to the nine other camps until 1943, when the U.S. government mandated that each adult in the camp answer a loyalty questionnaire. Now, there were two questions of that questionnaire that caused some confusion. One asked if they were willing to serve in the armed forces wherever necessary, and the other question asked them to swear allegiance to the United States. Now, imagine you've been forcibly removed from your home with days' notice. You had to sell your property, your business, if you were able to. You lost your job. The majority of possessions that you owned are gone. You've now been incarcerated. Now you're being asked, will you enlist in the military and die for this country who has done this to you? Will you swear allegiance to this country? For those who said no to these questions because they didn't understand what was being asked of them, you know, if you're an 80-year-old woman, you're being asked, will you join the military? Will you serve? How do you answer that? So for those who said no to these questions, either because they didn't understand what was being asked or because they were angry, now they're being segregated at Tule Lake. Inmates at other camps who were thought to be disloyal or who had protested conditions in any way or were simply labeled a troublemaker, they are also sent to Tule Lake. And our next two podcasts are going to be dedicated to Japanese incarceration. We're going to be joined by Angela Sutton, who is an interpretive ranger for the National Park Service at Tule Lake National Monument. And I hope that you will join us for this incredible conversation.
Thank you for listening to U.S. History Repeated with Jimmy and Gene. Tell your friends about our podcast and where you learn all this great stuff about U.S. history. Follow us on social media and get onto our email list to learn about special events. They're coming up again. There's always more to learn. Talk to you soon.